I'm sitting here with Stan Goff, and I was going to introduce you, but why don't you introduce yourself? I understand you were in Special Forces in the military at one point.
I was in Special Operations, and Special Forces, one component of that. I started out as a parachute infantryman in Vietnam, and then by and by ended up working in Ranger Battalions, and from Ranger Battalions from my first Ranger assignment, I went to work as a small unit tactics instructor over at the Jungle Operations Training Center in Panama. Went from there to Delta and worked there almost 3 years.
And Delta is?
Delta is a First Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta. So popularly, it's called Delta Force. It's a counterterrorist organization based out of Fort Bragg. And from there, I worked for a short time for three semesters as a military science instructor at West Point. I went back into 1st Ranger Battalion. I worked there as an infantry platoon sergeant, and then went to the Special Forces Qualification Course, which is different than SFOD, which is a peculiar unit sort of off from the rest of the Army. Went into Special Forces proper, which is what people call, they refer to them as Green Berets. Went through training there as a Special Operations Medical Sergeant, working on the Special Forces A Detachment in 7th Special Forces, which is their area of operational responsibilities in Latin America. And from there, went back to work as a regimental SF medic with 75th Ranger Regiment. That's the organization that I went to Somalia with, and then was promoted, and being promoted in my branch put me in the position of being an operations intelligence sergeant, a team sergeant for Special Forces again. So I got sent back to 3rd Special Forces. Their AOR is Sub-Saharan Africa and the Caribbean, and it was with 3rd Special Forces that I went to Haiti. That was my last assignment. And then I retired. all those things, the Ranger Battalions, Special Forces, Delta, those are all a subset of something called Special Operations. And each of them have real distinct missions. The Rangers work as a kind of supplementary shock infantry to groups like Delta and SEAL Team 6 that do what they call special operations in sensitive political environments and different kinds of what they call surgical operations, hostage rescue and things like that. And then some of the, the spooky stuff that you sort of hear through the grapevine now that's been going on in Afghanistan and in Iraq.
What kind of spooky stuff?
Interdiction, targeted assassinations and stuff like that. So that's a direct action unit. Their primary mission is to go attack something, but it's the target. It's the type of targets, the strategic type of targets that Delta deals with, and in situations like hostage rescue where they require a high degree of skill, precision marksmanship, and learning the tactics necessary to do dynamic entries into closed man-made spaces, like buildings, and aircraft, and trains, and buses, and things like that.
Who determines the mission? How is it determined, and on what basis?
Well, a mission is something that someone makes up. So, they don't just make it up, but a situation comes up, and then in the National Command Authority and other people get involved, depending on the situation, and assessing what the circumstance is and deciding what's the most appropriate kind of mission. Then when they decide what the appropriate kind of mission is, that determines the composition of the forces. In many cases, these are combined. The Task Force Ranger mission to Somalia had all those elements. They had special operations, paramedic, these flight paramedics that work with the Air Force. They had 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, which the people that fly the tricked out helicopters with all the forward-looking infrared, and they fly blacked out, and the pilots wear the night vision goggles, and they're specially trained. And they had the Rangers there as the shock infantry to set up these strong point security positions for the surgical operations that Delta was doing. So we had Delta. We had elements from the Ranger battalions. We had special operations aviators. We had Air Force special operations all together. And then the support units that go with them. So, and that's a pretty typical... that's a pretty typical mission package for them to be mixed up that way, because everybody, it's becoming more and more specialized as time goes by. It used to be that there were fewer units that were doing these things, and they were just task organized to do them. But now, you know, they get pulled together because there's been a refinement and a focus on more specialized training for each of them. I'm not sure that's been a big advantage, but that's a different discussion. You know, we go off into a doctrinal discussion or anything.
Well, actually, it is relevant. I understand that Rumsfeld was very much interested in military transformation to build military units that could go in and basically do what are essentially basically targeted missions that alter the political dynamic in place.
Yeah, and those are Delta-style missions. The problem that Rumsfeld has is he doesn't understand anything that he thinks he's an expert in. And he doesn't understand the reality behind them. I'd go to jail if I tell you how many people are in Delta. It's a very small unit. This notion of just, you know, building all these basically, you know, Delta teams all over the place, as if the supply of people who are capable of doing this is absolutely infinite. And on the other hand, replacing straight up ground troops who are really, you know, the core of one's military power, if you're talking about actually seizing and holding ground, that's the Marine Corps of the Army. He's cut their numbers drastically. He says he wants them leaner and meaner. He's just got them smaller. I mean, he's just cut the numbers way back, and believes that by introducing all sorts of high technology gadgets, to extend their senses, improve their weapons, and in fact now even replace human decision making with digital systems, that this is going to compensate for the loss of actual, you know, what people refer to as boots on the ground, which is something that people have picked up with the Iraq War. And it's a delusionary doctrine, and it's been proven in Iraq, it's been proven that it doesn't work. Even though nobody wants to talk about that, they say, you know, we had this great military victory because in less than 4 weeks, we drove from Kuwait to Baghdad and conquered Baghdad. That's ridiculous. I mean, the original plan conceived of them doing this in 2 to 3 days. And that was stated. You know, they thought they would do it in 2 to 3 days. And Rumsfeld's doctrine had a great deal to do. The loss of the Northern Front in Turkey had a lot to do with it too. But nonetheless, to say, when you look at the extremely desperate situation that was in Iraq, the capacity of the Iraqi military to resist in numbers, technology, weapons, everything. And then look at the immense size, cost, capacity of the U.S. Army, or the U.S. Army, the U.S. military. To say that the United States Armed Forces defeating the Iraqis and conquering Baghdad in 3.5 weeks is a great military victory is like saying that if Mike Tyson fights a 10-year-old child and wins in the third round, that it's a great victory. I mean, that's what they're really saying. The doctrine is bad, even from a strictly apolitical, amoral standpoint. It's bad military doctrine. And it was being carried out in a situation that was politically untenable from the very beginning. But that's exactly how they got involved in Vietnam. There's this notion that military strategic and tactical outcomes
are the outcome, and that's not, I mean, you know, the military is an instrument of politics. The political outcome determines whether or not you have success or not. And right now what they have in Iraq is not a political success. In fact, I would even say it's not a tactical success. I think tactically and objectively on the ground, the United States Armed Forces are losing in Iraq right now.
How much of the opposition that people have seen developing to this, even within elite circles, is based on the sense that it was done wrong versus the sense that it was the wrong goal?
Well, I think among probably some of the smarter generals in the Pentagon, that those are not two separate issues, because they may have a good idea that tactical and political in the real world are sort of interfused.
But the idea that the U.S. should take control of the Middle East militarily or politically, or use a military approach at all to establish political control.
Much of the brass in the Pentagon was opposed to the Iraq war from the very beginning, because it was not a big intellectual feat to sort of foresee what's going on there right now. You know, the reason that they got involved in this situation is because this is an administration that intentionally surrounds himself with people who say the things that they know they want to hear. You know, they have a preconception, and they go find people to confirm those preconceptions. They don't they're not very good at accepting criticism.
Sounds very much like the Nazi system.
Yeah, well, and it could end up with the same disastrous results for them. In some ways, it's already started to. The primary advisor to the administration on what the situation was going to be like in Iraq was Ahmed Shalabi, you know, who had not been in the country for over two decades and who is currently facing 22 years of hard labor if he ever gets caught in Jordan for bank fraud and embezzlement. And this is the guy that told them what they wanted to hear, and so that's the guy that they listened to. I mean, you know, it's illogical, but these are people who have been sort of cooking up this idea for a long time. They've been infatuated with it. They're like, you know, they're like children who've finally broken into the closet and they found their dad's gun.
But it leads to the question of why it is that the dad's gun is so accessible. I mean, that's a larger structural question.
Yeah.
You know, when I watch the movie Uncovered and you see CIA analyst after State Department official after, you know, what have you, saying that they were outraged, that the president lied, that all the rest of this, it was terrible policy and the rest. And yet no comment on the fact that that structurally the entire system could be directed towards these goals so objectionable to so many people within it so easily doesn't seem to be a topic for discussion. So why is it that dad's gun is in the closet loaded with the safety off?
Well, I think you'd have to go back 20 years to figure that out. There's the Republican Party as an institution has been working very hard, very intentionally in a very disciplined way for a long time to move in a very systematic way toward establishing one-party rule in the United States. And, you know, I'm the first one to be critical. A two-party rule is really sort of, you know, one party with two names and that kind of thing. But this is a different thing that's going on. I mean, they've been very, very ruthless about consolidating their power under, if you're going to call it one party with two names, well, there's one wing of that party that's very much more inclined towards sort of a fascist worldview. And they've been effective. They've been effective at doing that. They've been effective at doing that because they've been very good at a lot of things in terms of just instrumental politics. And it doesn't hurt that they've been also very good at leveraging white supremacy in the general society in a way to establish a very strong popular political base, both among fundamentalist Christians and fiscal conservatives, many of whom have sort of libertarian tendencies. And then a lot of people who sort of have these notions of the Pat Buchanans of the world and whatnot. So it's a fusion party. And now we're seeing that fusion begin to take on an organizational aspect under what people are calling these neocons.
Could you expand a little bit on the notion of the use of white supremacy? Because I think a lot of people, when they hear white supremacy, they think of Klansmen. They don't think of it as a general property of white society.
Yeah, that's a deep discussion right there that needs to be had. White supremacy is an organizing principle of American society and has been from the very beginning. And it doesn't have to be, you know, I am the Klan going to burn a cross in your front yard kind of white supremacy. It can be the kind of white supremacy that just sort of tacitly accepts that white culture and white society is the norm and everybody else is whatever they are related to that or compared to that. But it's a more overt form of white supremacy that people can't talk about because the civil rights movement created a cultural condition where at least a lot of that was silenced. You know, we created some space in the years where all the progress was made around particularly the Black Liberation Movement. And it was a reaction to that that really turned the Republican Party into the party of white supremacy. I mean, if you think back just prior to Lyndon Johnson's administration, the Southern Democratic Party explicitly called itself the party of white supremacy. This is the party of George Wallace. It's the party of Lester Maddox. And that was part of their political appeal in the apartheid South. After that system of formal political apartheid broke down in the wake of those struggles, with the pivotal point being 1963, 1964, when legislation went into effect to codify the end of segregation, the Republicans started then thinking about how to leverage the resentment of white Southern males, not just against blacks, but also against what they felt like were incursions against their male supremacy. There was a great deal of concern about the direction that was being taken also by the women's movement. So this white male resentment that was out there was something that the Republican Party tapped into, and again was very explicit. It was called the Southern Strategy for the Nixonians. They formulated all their appeals, and they began to code their overt racism in different language, and you can still see that today. You know, they talk about we want neighborhood schools. Well, they don't want neighborhood schools. They want white schools. I mean, that's really the issue that's going on. So it's been recoded, but it's still there. And that's when the Republican Party started formulating all its appeals to target white male voters, who are a pretty formidable block. And then it also began to link up with this sort of millenarian wing of Christianity, which was based in a lot of churches who have in the past also been explicitly white supremacist, and not insignificantly now also Zionist, though not because they shared the ideas of Jabotinsky, but because they believe that the consolidation of the state of Israel is the last step before, I don't know, the seven horses of the apocalypse show up, and then all of them can go to heaven and all the rest of us can go to hell. Well, but I mean, you know, people really believe that. In fact, there's been polls even recently that show as many as half of all the people in the United States actually believe something to that effect. So,
well, so is this white supremacy you're talking about primarily a property of the right and of the Republicans?
I don't think so. No, I think the more overt form of white supremacy that exists, where people who are in comfortable spaces with their peers or in their homes will, you know, they'll refer to black people as nigger and whatnot. That's out there, and it's a lot more common than people like to admit, way more common than people that like to admit. But there's a lot of people who won't talk like that that also accept many ideas that are white supremacist, but not explicitly so that way, if that makes sense.
It does. Well, then you start grading in my mind to the concept of white privilege, and yeah. I start thinking of what's the relationship between white privilege and white supremacist. Is there any fundamental difference? Is one simply facilitatory? Does one make the other more possible?
Sure.
Are they different things? Are they similar? But I guess what I'm most interested in is when we talk about white supremacy, to what extent is it a property of white society in general, as opposed to just those with overt bigotry and hostility towards people of color?
I don't think it's possible. I think white supremacy is an organizing principle of American society. It exists sometimes in overt and antagonistic ways, and that's instrumental in mobilizing violence against certain populations at times whenever there might be some sort of a revolutionary upwave. And at other times, it recedes into the background and it becomes one of those things that is formative of everything, but it's not something that's out there for everyone to see. And I'm not sure enough if I'm articulating that, but it's if anybody that looks at this society right now and sees that, it looks at the difference between the net worth of the average white family and the net worth of the average black family in this country, and sees that there's a 12-to-1 disparity, and then can turn around and say, well, but that has nothing to do with slavery and apartheid.
Or that it's no longer relevant.
Or that it's no longer, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's an astonishing bit of denial.
Well, does that relate at all to the notion that as 5% of the global population, we control or consume between a quarter and a half of global resources? Is that also part of that mindset?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. The system itself reproduces its own justification. People in the United States feel perfectly entitled to drive around in these urban assault vehicles that get 6 miles on a gallon of gas. Partly because they don't think about it. But, you know, if there were a political policy that caused 1 million British citizens to die, and half of them were under the age of majority over the last 10 years, there would have been an outcry from people in the United States when the exact same situation actually occurred in Iraq over the last decade as a consequence of sanctions. There was no outcry. And it wasn't because people didn't know that those sanctions were that savage. They did know that. And they just didn't care. They just didn't care. That's a form of white supremacy.
And that's also happening with respect to the incarceration of people of color in the United States.
China has a population almost 5 times our size. China right now has around, I think, 1.6, 1.7 million people incarcerated. So here we are, almost one-fifth their size, with more people, more net people behind bars than China, and we have the gall to point fingers at China and talk about their human rights situation. But see, again, it's that imperial ideology, and people say, well, our people are behind bars because they broke the law. But, you know, we were just at an event yesterday where, people were protesting in front of City Hall here in Santa Cruz because they just wrote a law against people sleeping outside in town if they use a blanket. It's a blanket law. If you lay down and put a blanket over yourself in town, then you're put in jail and given a fine. It sort of brings to mind the old Anatole France quote, where he said the law in its majestic equality forbids rich as well as poor from sleeping under bridges and stealing bread. You know, I mean, this is what people don't recognize when they're saying that. And it has to be, at some level, an intentional failure to recognize. I mean, nobody's that stupid. This denial is intentional because people basically don't want to get off their asses and do anything about it. They don't want to acknowledge that they have any responsibility. And we have, that ideology of individualism is something that's an organizing principle too for this society, because it's based on competitive individualism.
I think now that we've set this tone, if we could talk for a minute about the structure of the interest section in each of the conflict areas that you've been involved with, where you were sent in. If we could talk a little bit about how that works and how the confluence of, economic interest, military planning, et cetera, works. I have this funny feeling we'll find our way back to this subject.
Yeah, I don't think you're always going to find your way back to race if you start talking about capitalism. Capitalism was built up on racial despair, not as a primary motive. I mean, the motive is always a self-expansion of value, but the self-expansion of value in the real world took place in that sort of, at least, Western imperialism, it took place in the routes that the ships took from Europe to Africa to the New World and back to Europe again. And that was, that system had to be rationalized, and it was rationalized racially, which is a fairly easy thing to do.
My understanding is it was rationalized religiously before the racial construction. Robert Williams traces American Indian law back to the Justice Marshall's decisions in the 1800s actually cite the papal bulls of crusade of the 1300s, where the church basically established the right of domination and alienation of lands over non-Christian peoples as a result of proper understanding of natural law and the Bible. And that those same attitudes, the exact same language, the direct citations of our relationship to the settler population's relationship to the indigenous population here was drawn from those, and directly from those justifications.
Oh yeah, and there's all the business of what it means to be white too. I mean, that's a construction that grew directly out of the situation in the United States. Capitalism, industrial capitalism, was built to a large extent in the American South. The industrial infrastructure was built up in Britain, but that industrial infrastructure was being fed via the colonies, which were being built up economically on slave labor, and it was the northern industrial region that was, the American South gave birth to the industrial North. And then the precocious child turned around and conquered its own mother, so to speak. But, the old vulgar Marxism that says you've got a base and a superstructure, and the base was the economic activity and the superstructure is this ideology. It's not really that way. The base and the superstructure feed one another. It's really more like an organic process where you have these feedback loops that reproduce a system. And that the system is not national It's a global system, and that's why when you look at the situations, you can look at Haiti. You got one situation going on. You got Colombia. You got another situation. Iraq. You got another situation going on. There's different variables at play, and all of those variables are interacting with one another. And it's not simply economic. People say, well, you know, we're in Colombia because there's oil there. We're in Iraq because there's oil there. Well, that's true. But Colombia has more significance than just its oil. If we got all the oil that was in Colombia, we'd get enough to supply the world for about 2 years. I mean, there's really not that much oil there. Most of the oil is where they are right now. The real issue in Colombia, and oil is one of those issues, but the real issue in Colombia is not economic. There's some economic investment there from the United States, but it's not totally economic. It's more geostrategic. Colombia is geostrategically located in an area, in a whole region that we have a colonizer relationship with throughout Latin America, and there's a very active and very successful armed insurgency going on there. That's the reason there's so much attention being paid to Colombia, because they can't afford to allow that example to stand. And in fact, without massive infusions of aid to the Colombian government right now, the FARC EP would be running that country within about 5 years. And that's just the truth, because their military is corrupt and incompetent, and their political leadership is some of the most vicious that we've seen in a long time. And that's saying a lot, given how vicious many national political leaders are right now. I mean, Uribe is clearly a fascist.
Can you give some examples about that?
Well, I mean, in 1991, you know, they've got these right-wing paramilitaries that go out there and routinely depopulate areas by intimidating peasants off the land, by doing selective massacres and whatnot. And this is something that happens all the time. The life expectancy of a trade union leader in Colombia right now is about 6 months from the time he or she begins to publicly become a trade union leader. I mean, it's one of the most dangerous jobs in Colombia right now, is to be a trade union leader, or someone who's trying to teach peasants how to read, or you know, or anybody that's left of center politically. You become a target. You become a target of these massively funded right-wing death squads. But these death squads are not operating independently. They first formed sort of a militia force from the landowners there, but they have been completely integrated into the Colombian armed forces, and officially so. In 1991... the United States government, including the Department of Defense, the Central Intelligence Agency, assisted the Colombian government in integrating the staffs of the AUC, this network of right-wing death squads, and the Colombian Armed Forces. You integrate the staffs of a military organization, then you've effectively made them the same military organization. The staff is the command structure. So it's the whole operation. They're sharing intelligence. They're sharing operational plans. They're sharing logistical support. They're sharing administrative capacity. They're sharing command and control. So the integration of these staffs constitutes an actual, objective integration of the Colombian Armed Forces of the AUC. But now, you know, they want to turn around and say, well, you know, the AUC are renegades, and they've actually declared them a terrorist organization now, under popular pressure. But the fact of the matter is, if we send $1 billion to Colombia under Plan Colombia, it goes to the Colombian Armed Forces, then we're supporting the AUC. You know, this stuff goes on routinely. In fact, what they've done is they've just built a system now where the Colombian Armed Forces will go into a region and establish a cordon sanitaire and seal the place off. And then the AUC goes in and does the wet work. So when something bad happens...
When you say wet work, you mean assassination
That's right. They kill the livestock, burn the villages, kill the people. And then they come back and say, well, the AUC did it. But the AUC was given the freedom to operate because they've got a cordon that's out there, a huge perimeter around them, sealing the place off from the actual active duty Colombian Armed Forces. And that's common practice. Everybody knows it's going on. The U.S. government knows it's going on and sanctions it at the highest levels. If they say otherwise, they're lying. And everybody down there knows. There's probably 2,000 people rotating in out of Colombia right now, largely out of 7 Special Forces. We were briefed on this before we went down there, and that was back, you know, when the pretext was it's a war on drugs. We did not know ein fucking thing about counter-narcotics. Our expertise was in developing a counterinsurgency capacity, and that's exactly what we did. We knew that when we went down there. We were told in the PAO briefing, whenever we went through Fort Clayton in Panama, which is where Southcom was in, you go through the theater command, you get your briefing, you go in and do your mission. Before we go in and do our mission, we were told, if anybody asks you, this is counter-narcotics. We knew what we were doing. The same thing in Peru, when I was working in Peru in 1991. Same thing. We weren't down there teaching counter-narcotics. Hell, the officers that we were working with were probably more involved in the narcotics trade than any of the people that we, I mean, you know, it was common knowledge. In fact, we were briefed on which of the officers that we were about to work with were guilty of the most human rights violations. These were in the intelligence summaries before we went down there. So for the United States to say, you know, we don't know what these people are doing, you know, or these are exceptions to the rule, these are aberrations, that's simply not true. They know clearly what they're doing down there right now. But back to my original point, this is not necessarily economic there. It's economic on a regional basis, but the military force is being applied selectively to contain a problem that could spread and jeopardize the investment climate throughout the region. Now it's not even so much investment. I mean, the system's been transformed into one now where the United States just sort of sits back and collects money through external debts, because they keep refinancing the debts of all these countries. And you've got some of these countries paying 50-60% of their GNP out right now to do external debt service, which means they have no money for internal development. They barely have enough money to keep the government running. All the rest of it ends up going back via the IMF directly back into Wall Street, because these are private financial operators that are actually setting up these debt refinancing packages. You know, this is what structural adjustment is. Structural adjustment is loan sharking. And if they don't pay their debt, if they threaten to go into default, then there's economic sanctions. If economic sanctions aren't enough, well, then, you know, then we got the gun. That's the system. Now, how does that system work on a day-to-day basis in each one of these places? It's not something that's real simple and straightforward, because you can't just jump into something as complex as society and threaten them with a bunch of guns. You know, it has to be structured through relationships that are on the ground, and that's what a United States embassy is. An embassy is the nerve center for U.S. foreign policy in any given country. And it's divided up, you know. It's got specialties. You've got the economic section in the U.S. Embassy, and they're liaisons with the National Chamber of Commerce. You got the MIL group, and they liaison with the host country military. You got the consular section that controls travel back and forth through passports and visas, and then you have the administration of the place itself. You have some Marine security guards. You got a security section, and the political section was the CIA, and then all these activities.
Excuse me, wait. You just said the political section is the CIA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The political section is a euphemism. The political section means the CIA. Now, all these people have one representative that's on the country team, and they have like the little staff meetings every day, and then people go out and do their job. So they're sort of reporting in. You know, if I'm with the econ section, I'm reporting in what's being talked about with the Chamber of Commerce, and you know how our little projects with them are going. And then the responsibility of the ambassador is to be the executive. You know, the person who, or the manager. Now, there's other organizations that aren't directly in the embassy that work through the embassy, report back to the embassy through these various sections, and they make things happen on the ground. And something that we were talking about this morning, and I'm trying to think how someone put it, but they said, you know, sometimes you can look at the day-to-day activities that people are participating in, and they all look good. But when you back up and see the aggregate of this whole system, it becomes perfectly evil. Well, that's the way, let's say, United States Agency for International Development works. You go out and look at what the AID does. They issue little grants, and they facilitate all these little projects all over the country. Someone over here is digging a well, and you know, someone over here is working on a little reforestation project, and someone over here is implementing a kindergarten breakfast program. And so you have all these mini projects going under AID. But what these things really do is they vector in the most talented members of that society, and oftentimes the young intelligentsia, people who want to do good, and tie them up in these little projects and pull them out of the equation when it comes to larger social movements that might challenge the exercise of U.S. power more generally. So it's very difficult to go up and say, man, this is a bad project you got here giving these kids breakfast. You see what I'm saying? That's not the evil. It's the aggregate that's the problem. Well, AID does, and AID also establishes relationships throughout the country and creates an information flow about what's going on in that society that comes back, and it's something that can be evaluated by the political section.
Which is the CIA.
Which is the CIA. And then you got the United States Information Agency. You know, they become like the propaganda wing. And they're very clever. They don't put out, you know, this like ham-handed propaganda. They're very clever. In fact, a lot of their stuff, if you hear like radio broadcasts from Radio Free Europe and all that stuff, which is United States Information Agency operation, it sounds like almost like, well, this is even more liberal than the stuff that I hear, you know, on the radio at home.
Sure, because it's broadcasting to an audience with a different political perspective.
And that's what people don't understand.
Domestic population.
Exactly. And in most cases, at least in my experience, everywhere else in the world, there's a much higher level of political sophistication. It's much harder to bullshit people in other countries than it is in this country because for a lot of reasons, the American society is deeply indoctrinated, and they're partly structurally indoctrinated by the level of comfort that they enjoy. But that's a different issue. The other thing that goes on is interference in the electoral process. And semi-fascist governments are only desirable in places where there are active armed conflicts. They are not the kind of stable governments that people need to go in and do economic activity. And the kind of stability they need is where the government is legitimized in the eyes of people through some sort of an electoral process. So there really is something to be said for implementing a structural, but bourgeois-dominated democracy in all these countries. And that doesn't just mean, see, a lot of times, like a native bourgeoisie doesn't have the same interest as the United States. Haiti's a good example. You know, Papa Doc, everybody thinks Papa Doc was right under the U.S. Papa Doc was against the U.S., Papa Doc represented a class of landowners who lived on a system of tenancy. These are the big grandons. They were the landowners who had sharecroppers working for them. That was a source of their wealth, but they were intensely nationalistic. They felt threatened by the introduction of capitalist methods of agriculture that were brought in with the United States, and the CIA actually attempted to organize a coup against Papa Doc. You know, using a different section, the money bourgeoisie, the comprador bourgeoisie, who traded internationally. I mean, you know, you had crops that were grown in a sharecropping system with the grandons sitting on top of that who were intensely nationalistic. But they were growing the crops. When the coffee was produced, it was taken to the port and it was exchanged through a comprador. This is a guy who is, you know, who buys and sells internationally, and that's how that system is articulated into the larger global capitalist economy. But this guy goes to school in France or the United States, you see, and so he has a different relationship to things. It's a much more financial relationship. He's a comprador, he's a speculator, and this becomes the class that the U.S. connects with to get rid of these nationalistic bourgeoisies. This is a very common pattern throughout Latin America. And so this technocratic class that aligns itself with U.S. interest then becomes sort of a caretaker ruling class. And they need to be legitimated in an electoral process, in some sort of a formal democracy, but to make those electoral results conform to the needs of the United States uses something called the National Endowment for Democracy, and within the National Endowment for Democracy is the International Republican Institute, the International Democratic Institute, and the Republican and Democratic parties are involved in this process as well, and they go in and systematically develop mirror images of the Republican and Democratic Party, and they develop candidates. They go develop the media so that they can support this, and they basically construct the entire electoral system as a mirror of this. If it's a country with a degree of political sophistication and enough class conflict that they're not going to get their anticipated result. And this is what happened. Well, a perfect example is Nicaragua. There were the Sandinistas who represented, you know, could bring together 40-50% of the electorate under them. And there was no coherent political opposition out there. The NED went in there and went through a long, painstaking, and extremely expensive process of not forming a political party. UNO wasn't a party. It was a coalition. It was all these parties whose sole purpose was to defeat in the electoral process the political formation that represented the interest of the majority of the people, and therefore, you know, established the political hegemony of a ruling class. This happened. It happened. The opposition that destabilized Yugoslavia was an NED creature. The opposition that's in Haiti right now, the Convergence Démocratique, they can't get 15% of the vote on a good day, is an NED creature. The National Endowment for Democracy, and they're networked with AID.
How are they funded?
They're funded through the U.S. Embassy. But the funding runs through front organizations and their representatives' foundations. So in a sense, they've got a way of saying that these are private foundations, but it's public money that goes through the private foundations, but it's definitely the U.S. government. And what their job is to guarantee an electoral result. Now, once they have their Republican-like party and their Democrat-like party, it's not a real big issue to them which one of them wins. You know, just as long as somebody there is going to support the program, you know, is going to get behind neoliberalism. When Aristide won in 1989 or 1990, he was not expected to run. He came out of left field at the last minute. They had the candidate of the United States was a World Bank executive named Mark Bazin. Mark Bazin was very unpopular among the Haitian masses. So what they needed was an opposition candidate that could be so god awful that it would make people vote for Mark Bazin. So the U.S. goes behind the scenes and recruits Roger Lafontaine, who, you know, is this vicious macoute, you know, a real criminal character and widely hated. And they bring him up as the opposition candidate. So now there's a choice between, you know, Roger Lafontaine, which is like, okay, now we got a choice between, you know, Al Capone on the one hand and this other guy, you know, this unpopular banker. So it's a setup. But at the end, when you get your result, President Bazin, it's like, well, there's democracy down there now, see? But what happened was, one of the little parties that got pushed out in this process said, well, you know, they were mad, and they went out and recruited the FNCD, I think was the party at the time. And they recruited this populist priest who was immensely popular throughout the country because he'd been involved in a lot of liberation theology type work through something called the Tiaglis, the little churches all over the country. And they had this social movement called the Lavalas, which is the cleansing flood. And the U.S. was caught completely unprepared for this. 3 or 4 weeks before the election, this guy declares, and they didn't think much of it. You know, the U.S. Embassy got caught flat-footed. And then when the results came in, he walked away with 67% of the vote. And it stunned them. I mean, American officials were storming out of the rooms when they got the result, and immediately began plotting behind the scenes through their surrogates in the FRAP, another right-wing death squad organization, and a guy named Emmanuel Constant to organize a coup d'etat, which is what they did. You know, 8 months later, he was out of there. But that's an example of how they work. You know, this. I think that the thing with Bazin and LaFontaine was, you know, it's funny, but that's the way that they operate. You know, it's we're gonna set up elections, but we're gonna come up with an acceptable result. An acceptable result is to accept the American diktat. You know, and that's the whole thing. You're gonna privatize your industry, and you know, yada yada yada.
It strikes me that there's this reflection between what goes on there and obviously what goes on here. The system works so well here. The candidates, once they're presented, both serve the same general interest. Now, that's not the case in the Bazin case, but more generally, Gore Vidal's talked about this, the fact that anybody who does not look upon this two-party system as a great gift from God to the capitalist classes is nothing but an ingrate. You know, a fool and an ingrate. But it seems to me that that's in the process of breaking down, that the people who are in power right now are so violating the unspoken rules within that system where you allow the nominal opposition, because they're not oppositional on the central tenets of how the system runs and how it ought to run. Mm-hmm. But they are oppositional in certain other narrow ways. But are the activities and policies of the current administration a threat to the two-party game that has served elites so well for so long?
I mean, I don't think that we're going to see the abolition of the two-party system in the immediate future, but I think it is breaking down. There's a process by which it breaks down. I don't think it's breaking down just nationally. We have to begin to see the position of the United States in the world system to really understand what's going on here. And in fact, I don't think that the neocons are deluded and the old multilateralists were the sensible imperialist. I think both of them are suffering from two different forms of delusion, because neither of them understand that they're confronting a situation worldwide where they can't escape the internal logic of their own system. They're not going to go back to multilateral exploitation by the global north of the global south, because the orange has been squeezed dry. There's not that much left. Somebody's got to seize on what's... And right now it's energy resources, because energy is so central to continuing a system of appropriation that benefits this capitalist class, with the dominant sector of that capitalist class here in the United States. And strangely enough, it's not really the productive capitalists who are in charge at this point. It's the finance capitalists and Wall Street that have the power. And that's because of the very specific construction of the world economy right now around dollar hegemony. But I think sort of going back to what we were talking about yesterday evening, you know, Marx called this the organic composition of capital. He said, you know, that there's a tendency of the rate of profit to fall, as more and more fixed capital, more and more the technological basis of capital accumulation grows and creates a need for fewer and fewer workers, even though the exploitation of the workers is the source of capitalist accumulation, at least on one level. I mean, that doesn't factor in the reproductive cost of a society that's based largely on the labor of women, and it doesn't take into account the natural consequences, the consequences to the biosphere of this whole process of exploitation. But it's true to an extent. And what's going on right now is there's the people who are on the land throughout the world are being thrown off the land because more and more and more of the land is now being appropriated for the purpose of capitalist agriculture to feed a burgeoning population that is growing within the logic of a growth economy. And these people are being pushed into urban areas. Urban areas are areas that are energy sinks, they're monetary sinks, and more as the immiseration of the exploited global south increases, this is creating situations where we have these megalopolises that are beginning to grow. So you've got this decanting of the countryside, or the population of the countryside, into cities. It's a demographic shift that's never happened before, and it's something that's new in the world. And I think it signals some catastrophic changes in conjunction with a thermodynamic cliff that we're approaching right now as we begin to see the depletion of fossil fuels upon which the entire system is so utterly dependent. These cities themselves, if you look at a city as a system, it's an unsustainable system. You can look at a situation like Los Angeles right now that sucks the Colorado River dry before it ever reaches the ocean. I mean, that's not a sustainable system. You can look at a situation in the United States where we see the Ogallala Aquifer is beginning to disappear. And as it disappears, there's all sorts of other sequelae involved in that. You know, there's a concentration of the water and concentration of the toxins in the water. And, you know, all these phenomena are beginning to move toward it. And I think about it sort of in terms of a perfect storm. These people who were living in the countryside, even though they were poor, always had the fallback position of subsistence agriculture. When you put all these people in the cities, they don't have the fallback position of subsistence agriculture. And I think we've entered a stage now where this no longer constitutes what Marx called the reserve army of labor. There's way more people than what are needed because of this organic composition of capital, more technomass than there is biomass, if you're looking at the workers as biomass in the system. And now what they are excess people. And so I think the real goal of the neocons, which in some ways is more realistic from the point of view of the capitalist than the multilateralist position, is that they've got to let these people die off. But they have to manage that in a way that doesn't destabilize a system so that they can't continue to flourish and accumulate capital. And for a lot of reasons, I mean, I really do see this as the beginning of the end of 20th century capitalism, now that we're in the 21st century. I don't think that automatically translates into some sort of a utopia on the other side. I think there's a real choice that's in front of humanity right now to either find some way to make a soft landing from this incredibly dangerous and unsustainable path we're on, or we're going to see a situation that's going to be unthinkably horrible. And I don't think that's in the too distant future. I think for in places like sub-Saharan Africa, large parts of Russia right now, we're already seeing conditions that are really not suitable for life. I mean, these are conditions in which misery is the common denominator of people's daily existence.
It's the norm.
And I think that's the direction we're headed. And I really do think that there's an ecological component to this that has not been appreciated by the left as well as it should have, that we need to understand. And that's why I say there's this thermodynamic wall. If fossil fuel production is not only necessary for transportation and electricity, we can do without electricity. We could probably find a way to get by without all these private automobiles, though in the United States it would be much harder than other places because we've structured the whole society around the ownership by you know, every man, woman, and child has got to have their own automobile. So it'll be much tougher for us. You know, if I go to a place where people spend more time on foot than you're usually within walking distance of a green grocer or whatever, where you can't do that in a lot of places in the U.S. But this fossil fuel is also necessary for agriculture. And now the agriculture that feeds a 6-plus billion global population and especially feeds the imperial metropoles is going to come to a screeching halt in the next 30 years or so, because oil, the predominant fossil energy form that supports capitalist monoculture agriculture, is at its Hubbert peak right now, and it will begin to decline immediately, and it will never stop declining. The problem is that process becomes exponential, because to get at the amount of oil that's needed tomorrow requires more energy to get that less available energy out of the ground. So the energy itself runs up a higher and higher and higher energy cost. And it's not until the oil runs out. The oil won't run out. It'll get to the point where it takes more calories of energy to get the stuff out of the ground than what you get back from it, and it'll no longer make any sense to try to get it. But when you're looking at a situation where 6 billion people are dependent on this form of agriculture, and all of a sudden that agriculture stops and doesn't just stop and leave behind what was there before, but leaves behind desertified areas from deforestation, salinized lands, and, you know, all the other things, and not to even begin to talk about the consequences of the recarbonization of the atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuel. We've got a set of unintended consequences facing us right now that are going to be almost unimaginable in their import within a generation, I think. And so, you know, I mean, there's some people now that are saying energy is the final crisis of capitalism, which very well may be true. And people like Hornburg will argue that it's always been at the center. We just didn't see it. You know, it was one of those things that it wasn't in our way of understanding because we were still caught up in this notion that technology somehow exists out there independently of social systems.
I wanted to go back to one point you made. You said 6 billion people living and utterly dependent on this system. And my understanding is that there are, I don't know the numbers, but certainly more than a billion and possibly much more, are not living on this kind of fossil fuel-driven agriculture. They're living on historical forms of sustainable agriculture. And what the World Bank and other globalization processes are doing are destroying that basis of sustainability at an accelerating rate.
Exactly. Yeah. I think... those are the people that we may be looking to figure out how to survive in very short order if we don't continue to do what we're doing and push the rest of them off their land. But again, that's happening at an accelerating pace, because when people look at cities, they need to understand these cities as something that draw those resources in at an ever-accelerating rate. They require more and more and more all the time. And in what they export is this crap. You know, they export this social and ecological disorder in its place. So it leaves behind something that you can't start over.
I understand. And now it seems to me we do circle back to where we started, which is the role of white supremacy and white privilege in people of Anglo-European descent or more generally, however you want to construct it, white descent, who are living in urban, primarily an urbanized, commodified world, thinking that we are advanced in our utter dependence on these unsustainable systems, and people who are living in ways that are sustainable and have sustained communities and cultures for millennia are somehow primitive. And so unless there is a willingness to relinquish our sense of superiority and go to those people to learn from them as opposed to try and teach our way to them, I think we are not going to be able to be effective. And the key issue in all of this is how do decentralized sustainable systems like that defend their resource base against capture and against destruction? Mm-hmm. And the question I ask myself is, how can I, living as I do within the commodified, monetarized world, play a role in trying to protect those things that exist presently outside the system from being swallowed in such a destructive way that eventually the whole thing is wiped out?
Yeah, I mean that's a question everybody should be asking themselves right now. I think one of the things I just would mention in passing, but you're talking about people's sort of sense of superiority. One of the things that people will tell you is, like, I've been to all these third world countries, and they deforested. There's this erosion, all these terrible environmental problems, and you look around here, we've got all these trees. The fact of the matter is, the reason that we're able to preserve our forest, et cetera, here is because of what we've taken from someplace else. That's linked, and if people don't understand those links, they can sort of get into this notion that they can compartmentalize the world and give themselves credit for the fact that they can keep a lot of pretty green parks right here, when in fact those pretty green parks exist because we're stealing the resources that we would be using that wood for here did we not have access to them. We can't get away with doing it without military power, by the way. There's a lot of societies out there, and I don't think that the state is obsolete as an institution. I think the state is still relevant as an institution. The state is the institution that's being exploited, and the U.S. state is the centerpiece of global U.S. hegemony. In fact, the state is calling the tune to the economic powers in far more significant ways than the economic powers are calling the tune to the state. I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing the military come front and center in this particular historical conjuncture. But they have to look at the role of finance capital in all this, too. And one of the reasons that many of these people in other countries can't follow an independent development path is because they're locked into the system by financial dependency based on not only all these sort of machinations to manage the system that I was describing earlier and talking about embassies, but by the fact that the international financial system is one right now where there's only one universally accepted international currency that you can pay your energy bills and do international trade in is as dollars. And dollars that come from export are exports that are going primarily to the nation that now serves in the world system as the consumer of last instance, and that's the United States. I mean, that's our role in the world right now, is to consume from the rest of the world, and then we print dollars to cover our debts. The system that's developed right now is that all these nations' central banks are holding these huge quantities of dollar-denominated reserve currency to protect themselves from the kind of speculative attack that was waged against the Asian nations in the late 1990s under the direction of Robert Rubin and with the assistance of these giant hedge funds run by people like George Soros. They did that on purpose. They went and attacked those currencies as a way of punishing these people because they weren't going along with the IMF diktat. This was a way of saying, get your ass in line or suffer the consequences. So those kinds of activities and economic sanctions are out there as weapons. So the first step in breaking this system down is probably not going to come from inside the United States. I think people who are politically conscious and engaged need to stay engaged inside the United States, but we also have to learn ways of exercising real material solidarity with the struggles of people in other countries, again, because national independence is a real issue in places, and it's still progressive to be fighting for national independence if what you're fighting for national independence from is U.S. domination, because that's the problem. Right now, the central problem is U.S. imperialism. There's lots of other problems, but it's not human rights and all this other crap. It is U.S. imperialism. That's what's leading us toward the cliff like a bunch of lemmings. So, and the way out of this system is for people to find ways to reduce their dependency on these dollars. So those are individual political questions inside each one of these countries. But definitely the first step will be a default movement. And I think that's coming. I think
there's
going to
explain what you mean by default
movement?
Well,
because what the funding stream from these countries right now is to the United States via their external debt. Now they have to pay their debts to the United States in dollars. So they have to get dollars. So they convert their entire economy into an export economy and export to the United States to get the dollars that are cycled right back around and sent to pay the external debt, which means there's nothing left for internal development. And it doesn't just mean that there's no money to be directed. It completely reconforms the whole society around this export agriculture and export offshore assembly platforms and whatnot. So to get out of that, to break out of that paradigm, and to seek an independent path of development, and in many cases, I think people are interested now in seeking a path of development that aims toward sustainability by tapping back into indigenous cultures and beginning to think about things bioregionally and whatnot. But they can't do that until they get themselves free of the current financial architecture. And a default movement, it would be a movement where nations systematically set up a situation among themselves through various bilateral trade agreements or regional trade agreements, which I think is what is in the minds of people who are developing Mercosur in South America, for example, is to achieve a level of autarky, either regional or national, where they can turn around and tell the United States to go fuck itself. You know, we're defaulting. We're telling you right now, we're not paying this debt. But they've got to get in a position where the economic consequences of a decision like that are not going to destroy their ability to exist. That's that maneuvering is going on right now. And I think there are people out there who are geopolitical adversaries to the United States who are even thinking about actively promoting that type of a movement right now, because our adversaries, who are also our putative allies, are also caught in this system. The Europeans would very much like to get free of dollar hegemony. The Russians would be delighted to see the collapse of the U.S. empire. The Chinese know that they are objectively the most potentially the biggest economic competitor for the United States, and have said before that they're interested in what they call multipolarity, not just one center of power in the world. And so it'll be interesting to see how all this works out. But Latin America is particularly interesting to me, not just because I've got a little bit of experience there, but because a lot of things are going on in Latin America right now that could set examples for people around the world. And we've seen the overthrow basically of the Ecuadorian government. That doesn't mean that they don't have to default back to a neoliberal policy. They're still not in a position to get out of that dollar hegemony world system. The same thing with Argentina. But Argentina is pushing back against the IMF. Ecuador is pushing back against the IMF. Bolivian government was just overthrown by peasants blocking roads into the capital. And they're going to push back against the IMF. Venezuela's pushing back against U.S. hegemony in the region. The Colombian resistance, armed and otherwise, is pushing back against the Puerto Rican independence movement is growing stronger and pushing back against that kind of geopolitical domination. And so things are in motion. But I think we have to understand that the people who are going to be the key players in breaking this system down, because it is an international system, are going to be the people who feel the whips of this system most directly on their skin. And that won't be most of the people in the United States. The United States is going to be the last place, until the oil runs out, to really be hit with something that's so generalized and traumatic that it puts the country in motion. And I hope that doesn't happen in the immediate future, because right now I'd have a real concern that the majority of the white U.S. public, if they were really put under a lot of economic pressure, if something like a rapid deflation and a new Great Depression came along, would pay too close attention to the siren call of fascism. And again, it's because I don't think they get the system, and they'd be very quick to look for a scapegoated group, just as they're doing right now. I mean, there's really been no outcry against the roundup of Muslims and Arabs after 9/11. So I mean, it's already there. That fascist sensibility is already latent among a pretty significant portion of the U.S. population. So I think that's our domestic political task, is to win people away from those kinds of ideas. And then I think there's a larger international political task to find ways to achieve material solidarity with people who are pushing back against the system from the outside, you know. And in the immediate future, answering those questions about what is to be done, you know, it's the same type of thing that we've all been talking about here the last couple of days. You know, we've got to continue to just keep fighting for people's consciousness one person at a time, the best way we know how. And we have to be strategic about where we place our emphasis through mass activity and mass mobilizations. You know, I mean, my little piece of that is we're working on military communities, but other people are working on other communities. I think the mobilization of an anti-imperialist consciousness among Black and Latino people in this country is incredibly important, because there are a lot of parallels there. There's an initiative back where I live right now to build solidarity between Black people and Palestinians, because there's so many parallels between their experience as being an occupied, colonized people.
Indigenous people, you know, of this country.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much. I look forward to getting the information out there. My own take is that one thing everybody concerned about social justice needs to do is to be part of a decentralized system for disseminating information, a decentralized media, because media is one of the forms of power. And I think we need to build that infrastructure. That's one of the ways decentralized power can defend itself against the abuses of centralized power. But I really want to thank you for being here and talking about it, and look forward to doing it again.
Thanks.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.